seeing some states like Nevada, Kentucky, Arizona roll back on those reform efforts because they're coming to the conclusion that the reform efforts aren't working. Although I would argue as a researcher, they're coming to those conclusions prematurely, given that they are trying to implement these changes during sort of acutely challenging moments without sufficient resources. But nonetheless, we're now seeing, I think, a bifurcation across states and localities where some places are really doubling down on these investments in alternative practices and others are returning to more punitive approaches. And so I think, you know, we're at a challenging moment in this space, but the broader sort of history and context is helpful to keep in mind as we're navigating these policy discussions.
That was Dr. Rachel M. Pereira, a fellow in the Governance Studies Program for the Brown Center on Education Policies at the Brookings Institution, speaking on a webinar hosted by the USC Annenberg Center for Health Journalism entitled Suspended, Student Mental Health and Unequal Discipline. And for now, that's it. Join us again next week for another edition of Prison Pipeline. For now, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long!
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
Does your employer have a matching gifts program? Many companies offer dollar-for-dollar matching charitable contributions for donations you make to KBOO. The impact of your gift may be doubled or possibly tripled. Participating companies also match gifts made by retirees and/or spouses. Matching gifts are a great way for you to maximize your membership dollars. Check with your company's human resources or accounting departments to find out if your employer matches charitable contributions, then request a matching gift form. For more information on companies making matching gifts, go to kboo.fm/employer matching.
1, 2, 3, 4. Y'all ready for this?
Ladies and gentlemen.
A warning before we start. This episode makes mention of sexual assault and violence. Our friends from the podcast Kerning Cultures brings us Black Panthers in Algeria. It's the story of when Elaine Mactafi, the American and Algerian activist and author, landed in newly independent Algeria in the early 1960s. And quickly found herself at the center of a special period in the country's history, at a time when Algiers welcomed liberation groups from across the world, earning a reputation as the Mecca of revolution. Here's host Dana Balut and Dina Sabrine.
We are facing a common enemy, and it is this common enemy which we must all crush.
A Delta Airlines jet from Detroit to Miami was taken over by 8 passengers who demanded $1 million and a one-way trip to Algeria. The plane taxi to a remote area of Miami International Airport.
I was raised in small towns, upstate New York and in Connecticut. And I lived on a farm for a long while. My grandfather had a farm, and I lived on the farm.
When Elaine Mactafi grew up and became a young adult, she moved away from the family farm and became obsessed with politics. As a student in the 1940s, she got involved in America's anti-war groups.
We worked with an organization called the United World Federalists.
But by the end of the Second World War, she wanted to see more of the world. She was 23 when she got on board a ship from Virginia, bound across the Atlantic for France.
In those days, we traveled by boat. There were no planes crossing the Atlantic.
She loved Paris before she even arrived. Her imagination was full of the romance of being an American in Paris, in the early 20th century, way before Emily in Paris. It was where F. Scott Fitzgerald had lived, where Hemingway had written A Movable Feast. But when she arrived, that romanticism quickly dissipated.
And it was there that I discovered that there was a big problem with Algeria.
As tension rises in French North Africa, France arms her Algerian supporters for defense against rebel raids.
By the 1950s, when Elaine arrived in Paris, France was struggling and divided, desperately trying to cling on to its colonial rule in Algeria, which had been a colony of France and occupied by them for more than 120 years. Their rule was one of violent tyranny, where torture, mass displacements, and discrimination against Algerians were endemic.
Following the killing of 9 soldiers in a rebel ambush, French troops launched a full-scale drive against terrorists in Algeria.
But around this time, resistant movements across the globe were successfully launching opposition campaigns against their colonial occupiers. And in Algeria, the independence movement was called the Algerian National Liberation Front, the FLN. You'll hear that term a lot in this episode. And in 1954, the FLN launched a guerrilla war against the French military.
The Algerian War was one of the most important, most significant wars of the 20th century. We don't always realize what it meant for a victim of colonialism to stand up and fight.
Only negotiation with the Algerians will solve the problem. Only the recognition of the Algerian national realities and the right of that country to independence will end the shedding of blood and will permit France to consolidate...
In France, the war became a defining political issue, and everyone took sides. Thousands of people marched through the streets of Paris, both against and in favor of French rule in Algeria. And there was Elaine. She had found herself an apartment in the North African quarter of Paris. And the way North Africans were treated in France reminded her of the way Black Americans were treated in America. It made her angry. And as she learned more about the colonial war in Algeria, she wanted to join the protest movement against it, similar to the way she joined anti-war groups in America. And she began making connections in the Algerian resistance community, marching in anti-war demonstrations and working to support the cause however she could.
Our job mainly was to try to get the United Nations to pass a resolution in favor of Algerian independence. It was very difficult at the time.
It took years of struggle and hundreds of thousands of lives lost, but in March 1962, France reluctantly conceded and signed a set of peace treaties with the Provisional Government of the Algerian Republic. In a referendum later that year, the people of Algeria were asked if they wanted their country to become independent. 6 million people came out to vote, and over 99% voted yes. After the withdrawal of the French troops, it was finally possible for thousands of people like Elaine, who had supported the Algerian independence from afar, to finally visit the country. She got on a plane as soon as she could, arriving one evening in October 1962 on a packed Air France flight bound for Algeria.
I was there for the November 1st celebrations of Algerian independence. A very exciting time of celebration with lots of friends of Algeria at war and at present at the celebrations.
She had never planned to stay in post-independent Algeria permanently, but that changed within a few days. She found a 3-bedroom apartment for herself, a job with the tourist authority, and began to settle in.
And I felt that this was maybe my home.
Elaine had settled in her new home right at the beginning of an extraordinary period in Algeria's history. Because over the next decade, she would have a front row seat as resistant movements from across the world converged on the country, turning it into a melting pot of left-wing political ideas. And in this unlikely setting, she moved in the same circles as revolutionaries, ragtag political parties, spies, and military leaders. And she was witness to the final days of one of the most iconic liberation movements of our time, the Black Panthers. As Elaine puts it, a brief window of hope before it crumbled and the world changed forever. Producer Dina Sabris takes it from here.
During French colonial rule, most ordinary Algerians had very little contact with French institutions, and there weren't very many Algerians in positions of power. So when the French settlers left, they left behind a power vacuum.
So this creates sort of an immediate sort of practical problem that the new Algerian government has to deal with.
This is Natalia Ben Khaled Vince. She's a historian of the French Empire, decolonization, and post-colonial histories, and a professor at the University of Oxford. Following independence, the Algerian National Liberation Front, the FLN, suffered an internal split. After a bit of infighting, eventually a man called Ahmed Ben Bella created the political wing of the party, and the army installed him as the first president of the newly independent Algeria.
There is some opposition to that, but really by that point, you know, Algerian people are pretty sick and tired of war. So sort of an uneasy compromise, if you like, comes about. And by autumn 1962, at least publicly, at least, you know, the people in power, Ben Bella and the people sort of around him, are not particularly sort of openly contested.
As Elaine was settling into her new home in Algiers, halfway across the world in California, a man called Eldridge Cleaver was on the run from the police. In a twisted interpretation of justice, he saw the sexual assault of white women as part of his so-called revenge against white people, and he was wanted on several charges of rape, assault, and attempted murder.
You know, I think that one of the things that's important about Cleaver is that we look at him by holding kind of two contradictory thoughts in our head at once.
This is Justin Gifford. He's a professor of English at the University of Nevada in Reno and the author of Revolution or Death, The Life of Eldridge Cleaver.
And one of those ways of thinking about him is that he was deeply committed to Black liberation in a very radical way. At the same time, this is an individual who raped women, who went to prison for assault. So I think it's important for people to be able to see both of these sides of Cleaver, because that's the truth.
When the police caught up with him, he was convicted and sent to prison. During his time there, he wrote a collection of essays called Soul on Ice.
I'm perfectly aware that I'm in prison, that I'm a Negro, that I've been a rapist.
And it was a hit, selling 200,000 copies in just a couple of years. He quickly became an influential symbol of Black resistance during the 1960s.
Ladies and gentlemen, it gives me great pleasure to introduce our guest, a remarkable individual, Mr. Eldridge Cleaver.
Cleaver had also started reading up on the teachings of the civil rights leader Malcolm X, and he was inspired to begin making plans to launch his own political movement.
Malcolm X was actually dead already at this point when he got out of prison in the late 60s, and Cleaver decided that he was going to organize his own political group, radical political group, that would eventually try to overthrow the United States government. Before he was able to do this, he met with the Black Panthers for the first time, and they enlisted him to be their Minister of Information.
The Black Panther Party was set up to fight for Black liberation against American imperialism and institutional racism.
The Panthers believe the whole economic and political system is against them, against the poor Black and white. And that if death is the result of picking up the gun, well, that's the price you have to pay for what you believe in.
Their message was potent, and they began to rally support from across the U.S.
All power to the people! All power to the people!
Their slogans, like power to the people, became everyday expressions. And their image was just as iconic, dark sunglasses and black leather jackets. They began running community action schemes.
Panthers say that 6,000 children are served breakfast across the country each week.
Breakfast for children, healthcare, after-school programs, and organizing marches.
And then
some very sad news for all of you, and I think sad news for all of our fellow citizens and people who love peace all over the world. And that is that Martin Luther King was shot and was killed tonight in Memphis.
America is shocked and saddened by the brutal slaying tonight.
After Martin Luther King was killed in April of 1968, Cleaver decided that he was going to use that moment to try to start the revolution.
The people are going to wage a people's war against you.
In Cleaver's worldview, Martin Luther King's peaceful politics had gone in the Black liberation movement nowhere. They needed to be more direct and more violent.
And so he and a number of other Black Panthers tracked down various white police officers and attacked them in a gun battle that left one Panther, Bobby Hutton, dead and Cleaver in prison.
But they literally murdered Bobby Hutton and shot and wounded Eldridge Cleaver and Warren, these other men.
Cleaver was let out on bail, and he decided that he would rather flee the country than go back to prison again.
I went to the penitentiary to investigate it for you, and I didn't like it. But I want to stay out here where the people are and let the penitentiary be for the pigs. That's who belongs.
So in 1968, he traveled to Cuba on a cargo ship. He saw the Cuban president, Fidel Castro, as a potential ally in his fight against American imperialism. And he thought he might be able to garner his support to help with things like training for the Black Panthers. But his plan didn't get very far. Shortly after arriving, a Reuters correspondent recognized Cleaver on the street and blew his cover. On top of that, his hopes of getting any support from Fidel Castro were drying up.
As it turns out, Cuba didn't want to have anything to do with this kind of activity. Relations between Cuba and the United States were already fraught as it was. And so they quickly shuttled him off to Algeria in the summer of 1969.
At the time, Algerians had just overthrown French colonial rule, and the newly instated government was keen to support other anti-colonial movements however they could.
So there's this idea that Algeria sort of threw off the yoke of colonial rule against the odds, and they don't see this struggle as sort of ending sort of once national independence has been achieved. It's sort of a global struggle against the forces of imperialism and oppression. What that means in practice is that Algeria becomes something, a hub of sort of, you know, revolutionaries and anti-colonialists sort of from around the world. So it's really sort of cultivating this image, if you like, of a mecca of revolution.
The Algerian government helped out resistance and leftist groups in two ways: military support through weapons and training, and political support by lobbying on the world stage. They also adopted an open door policy, inviting opposition leaders from around the world to Algiers, like the National Liberation Front of South Vietnam, various Palestinian liberation groups, and exiled politicians from Brazil, Argentina, Tunisia, and Morocco. So Eldridge Cleaver, when he arrived in the late 60s, was looking for the same thing he'd gone to Cuba for: an opportunity for the Panthers to earn more recognition, financing, and training to revolt against the U.S. government.
Actually, he arrived in Algeria, and the Algerian authorities had not been warned that he was arriving, and so no one was at the airport to meet him.
Late that night, the telephone in Elaine's apartment rang. On the line was the leader of another visiting liberation movement. He'd been trying to reach her for hours. He told her Cleaver was in town, and since she was one of only a handful of French-speaking Americans in Algiers, he asked her if she'd go and meet him.
So I did go. He was in a hotel that was at the time called the Victoria. And I went there the next day, and I met him, and his wife was with him, and an American journalist, and another member of the Black Panther Party. Eldridge told me his story and said that he would like to remain in Algeria, and I happened to know the head of the Liberation Movement section of the National Liberation Front. So I called him and told him about Eldridge having arrived in Algeria. And he said he was more than welcome. And I relayed this message along, and Eldridge then organized a press conference.
We came over here to do what we can to communicate to you what's happening in our struggle in the United States.
At the press conference, Cleaver announced his arrival to an auditorium filled with journalists, students, and diplomats.
And to learn what is happening over here, and what have been the successes, and what have been the failures, and what are the dangers that we must be aware of.
Soon, more and more Black Panthers began to arrive in Algeria. The Algerian government gave them travel documents, a monthly stipend, and a villa to work from. A two-story house with huge arched doorways and manicured hedges.
It was a private house. private. I mean, it was a government house, but it was a home.
It looked like a boutique hotel, except by the entrance was a shiny silver plaque with the Black Panther's logo and the words Black Panther Party, International section. It was the group's first overseas outpost, with Cleaver and his wife Kathleen living in Algeria full-time, leading its operation.
Yes, I think the Algerian authorities were very sensitive to the problem of Black Americans, and they gave them their support.
They set about creating alliances with other liberation groups from places like China, North Vietnam, and the Congo.
Often invited to other embassies or liberation organization headquarters. And we were very close to the Viet Cong representative. He was one of the first people that Eldred visited when he arrived in Algeria, was the representative of the Viet Cong, Tran Hoi Nam.
We join hands with the Vietnamese people because the Vietnamese people are fighting the pigs of the power structure. And we're fighting the pigs of the power structure, and we're both oppressed. We're both dying. And we both know that we must put an end to this. We need each other, and we love each other.
So Cleaver was really trying to establish these connections in order to get not only like training and advice, but also to try to build a coalition, a global coalition, between and among various peoples of color. The thinking here was that someone like Martin Luther King's assimilationist philosophies were not going to get the Black population anywhere in the United States, precisely because they were an oppressed community under a police state. And so the only solution to this problem was to overthrow what they saw was a colonial authority.
We are facing a common enemy. And it is this common enemy which we must all crush if our Afro-American brothers score success in the United States. That success is not only theirs, it is ours too.
I was very glad that I was in a position to help them. It was one of the causes I was most sensitive to, the cause of racism in the United States. I was extremely sensitive to that cause. It was one of the causes that was most was closest to my heart.
When Cleaver first joined the Black Panthers, the FBI saw them as the biggest internal threat to the security of the United States. So with him out of the country, they saw an opportunity to drive a wedge between the Panthers in California, run by Huey Newton, and the faction working under Cleaver in Algeria.
For Newton and the Panthers in the United States, they were really interested in shifting the party toward community programs. So free breakfast for children, free tests for sickle cell disease. They had an ambulance that they ran through Oakland to help sick people. So the Panthers in the United States were shifting more toward kind of a reformist mainstream political model. And at the same time, Cleaver was in Algeria really hyping up his approach, which is all about Black insurrection and overthrowing the government. And he was deeply militant. So there was already an internal split, but the FBI really exploited that by sending false letters both to Cleaver and to Newton, essentially accusing the other one of trying to take over the party.
This all came to a head on live TV. Newton was a guest on a show called AM San Francisco, and Cleaver phoned in from Algeria to air his grievances.
I just want to comment.
The whole thing descended into chaos. And Newton expelled Cleaver and the entire international section of the party right then and there.
So you're a coward and you're a punk, you understand?
I think you've lost your ability to reason, brother.
Hey, brother, you know what I'm calling you, that's what I feel about you now. You're a punk.
Eldridge Cleaver had been cut off from the Black Panthers in the U.S. and needed money to finance his branch of the party in Algeria.
In 1973, a couple of Panthers actually hijacked airliners.
There was another airplane hijacking today, a Delta Airlines jet taken over by a gang of hijackers after landing in Miami to pick up the biggest...
with between $500,000 and $1 million, and came to Algeria to give the money to Cleaver.
Did the hijackers say where they wanted to go, or did you talk with them at all?
No. Stewardess said they wanted to go to Algiers.
But the Algerian government seized the money.
The U.S. demanded that the ransom be returned. An official said they expect Algeria to comply.
And gave it back to the airlines because they were in the middle of brokering a deal with the United States over oil rights, and they didn't want to disrupt any sort of relationship with the U.S. So at that point, Cleaver and the group of Panthers that remained had a press conference and wrote this press release in which they basically demanded the money from the Algerian president. And the president reacted by sending Secret Service agents to try to assassinate Cleaver, and he and Kathleen were just barely able to get out of there alive.
Natalia spoke to one of the people in the Algerian Civil Aviation Authority who was responsible for dealing with these hijackings. Although Algeria had been a so-called Mecca for revolutionaries at the time, he said that these hijackings were a step too far.
So from independence, the Algerian government has to walk a fine line between sustaining this reputation of being the Mecca of revolution, of being sort of this pilot revolutionary state, this inspiration for liberation movements around the world, and its need and desire to be seen as a normal country playing by the rules of international relations. That cautiousness also becomes entangled with the idea of international respectability. Yeah, so they actually want to be seen as a normal state playing by the normal rules of international diplomacy. And when, you know, your country becomes really well known for welcoming plane hijackers, that actually is a challenge to that image. You want to be an international broker, not kind of like a rogue state. So in that sense, sort of the plane jackings become a political problem.
For the Algerian government, the Panthers had crossed a line with these attacks. It wasn't a good look for them to be seen supporting a group that had resorted to hijacking planes to fund their cause. So they started to withdraw their support.
And that was when the Panthers had to take stock of what their position was internationally, and they had lost a lot of their influence because of the split and because of the FBI intervention. So things changed rather rapidly for them, caused the breakup of the Panthers in Algiers, and many of them moved along to other countries to settle and live.
Cleaver left Algeria for Europe in 1973. He snuck into France and later got a visa to live there. He flew back to the U.S. 2 years later and was arrested as soon as he landed in New York.
With his hands cuffed behind him, Cleaver was processed by the FBI and then taken by car to a federal court in Brooklyn.
He died in California in 1998. Elaine was deported in 1976. She says it was because she refused to become a spy for the Algerian government.
Yes, they contacted me and I refused, and the final result took some time, but the final result was that they deported me because I wouldn't work for them.
She went to Paris for a few years before moving back to New York. The Panthers had moved to Algeria at a time when the future was still up for grabs. Between 1950 and 1962, more than 30 African countries gained their independence. For a moment in time, it seemed like the colonial capitalist template that dominated the world for centuries was being dismantled.
It was an unbelievable period of time. We believed that the Third World had gained its place in the world forever.
But that quickly changed when the Cold War ended in 1991. In Algeria, support for liberation movements started to dwindle after the Panthers left. In 1971, the government revived relations with the U.S., and the two countries signed a 25-year-long gas agreement. Algeria's heyday as a haven for revolutionary groups was over.
Little did we know that the whole world would become capitalist in a short period of time, that the East would disappear and the West would be a long-time winner. And there were so many favorite memories. Can't number them all. They sort of flash across my mind from time to time, but I met my husband-to-be in Algiers in 1972. That's an unforgettable experience. I worked at the Algerian press office and was there the day that we were asked to be part of the film, The Battle of Algiers.
Peuple algérien, votre action est dirigée contre le colonialisme.
And I actually spent a day with the group that filmed Ponte Carvo's fantastic film. I was even present in that film for about 20 seconds. There were so many. I mean, meeting the Viet Cong and becoming friends with the leaders of so many progressive organizations.
Must fight together in Africa, in Asia, in Latin America, and inside the United States itself.
It brings back many memories. Makes me want to cry.
This episode, Black Panthers in Algeria, was produced by Dina Sabri and Alex Atak for the podcast, Kerning Cultures. Stories from the Middle East and North Africa and the spaces in between. I'm Anita Johnson. Thanks for listening.
Bienvenidos y bienvenidas. Welcome to PNA Poor People's Revolutionary Radio. This is your co-host Muteado Silencio, con voces de migrantes en resistencia, with formerly houseless poverty scholar, Popoy Tiny.
Are you in a fog? Occupied Turtle Island Nation? I mean inauguration. I mean hater nation. I mean confused settler violent domination. I mean, I got mine, even though this isn't your land settler population. I mean black and brown, confused by new colonial plantation. I mean, come on, family. The crack are coming back to the white people's house. You gotta get ready for Americlan hateration.
Reagan sold coke, Obama sold hope, Donald Trump spent his trust for money on the vote. I'm from a place where you probably can't go. Speaking for some people that you probably ain't know. There's pressure built up and it's probably gonna blow. And if we say go, then they probably gonna go. You vote Trump, then you probably on dope. And if you like me, then you probably ain't know.
Today's show is focused on the emergency of our houseless bodies when we are outside. In this increasingly dangerous time of climate terrorism and criminalization, we'll be talking to houseless gentrified residents of Los Angeles who have been caught up in the ongoing raging fires of the last week. Then a segment from Crip Hop Nation on disabled elder and son victims of the LA fires. Then we will speak with fellow houseless family at Wood Street who have been supporting the houseless relatives of Huchun who are endlessly being swept to nowhere. Finally, another segment from the new Poor People's Radio Workshop graduate, Lijay, with Addiction Doula.
We know that the crisis of our houseless bodies happens with or without the crisis of climate terrorism. And so many of us on the street are in the worst and first position to be hurt when there's these fires. But we're also continually destroyed by the hurricanes of criminalization and the violence of sweeps of our bodies like we're trash. Holding all of that in our hearts and holding our relatives in the occupied villages of Chumash and Tavangar peoples, aka so-called LA, and blessed to have family from Etna Street and Roofless and other warriors who are down in that territory dealing with this. Welcome, Carla, to Poor People's Radio.
Thank you, Tiny. Thank you, Poor Magazine.
I know that the air is really hard to breathe in, and we're already struggling with the violence of continual sweeps. What's happening right now?
For the last week, we've been dealing with evacuation warnings and orders. There have been unprecedented fires on these lands, and we've had to make plans as a community to evacuate 75 people who are living on so-called federal lands here in Van Nuys. And so we've had to make plans and take care of each other, all while the air quality, I mean, we have all kinds of chemicals, anything you can think of in the air right now. So people are dealing with kind of the everyday crisis of being unhoused. How do you evacuate when you've already been displaced? Just because the fires were going doesn't mean that the sweeps stopped. The sweeps continued. Even during what has been a serious period of loss, where thousands of people have now become houseless because of the fires, people here who are living on the streets are being swept every day.
So sweeping you in a fire, that's a new level. They sweep us in the rain. They sweep us in a fire. They sweep us in the heat. It doesn't really matter because our bodies are no longer considered human. What would you like to leave listeners with?
It's houseless people who've been showing the solidarity to one another. Like in the last week, we've learned even more about what it means to take care of one another and protect each other. There are friends here who can't walk, who would have no chance, but it's because of community care, because of the real solidarity that houseless people show each other every day, that people here have the skills. They don't have many resources, but they have the skills and the knowledge that actually is going to lead us forward. This is what people are going to have to learn all over the city that are learning now. You know, the cops roll by here every day. They patrol this community every single day, and not one person from the city came to even give people a warning. People have been abandoned, but people did not abandon each other here. And that to us is always the lesson. But we need to be thinking as a movement, because people here deserve dignity and permanence. People here who are going through so much each and every day are finding some strength and energy and saying, like, we've got to get together and we've got to make something happen. And people are going to have to listen. People have been left out here, and we're going to have to come up with our own solutions, our own answers. Our communities are going to have to be respected, and the displacement and the sweeps that are coming for people who lost their homes, who are under this threat of eviction, who don't know what is going to happen next week. That instability that more people have now been brought into, that is what we're going to have to deal with now. And we're going to have to look to houseless communities and people who have a lot to offer right now in this moment. That's what we know.
We love you. We'll be right back.
From the banks of the river to the banks of the greedy, all of the rich is taken back by the needy. We come from the country and we come from the city. Play us on a record, you can play us on a CD.
We know that in addition to a historically black community that had been a powerful force for generations, known as Altadena, basically burned to the ground. And one of the relatives that we lost, because there's an unknown toll of casualties of folks who died in these fires, are also disabled folks and elders. And one of those elders was actually trying to get an ambulance for their son who had cerebral palsy. This report comes to us from our brother, who also has CP and is a badass warrior with our sister movement, Poor Magazine, but also Crip Hop Nation, a co-founder of Homefulness, Leroy Moore from UZLA.
I like to read a poem that I just wrote for a black disabled father and his disabled son that was killed in the fires. This is called Father and Son, Crip Love, life and death, dedicated to Anthony and Justin Mitchell of Altadena, California. Fire, 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 flames getting hotter, disabled father and son staying together. Ambulance never came. Speaking in the family's name, Anthony and Justin Mitchell, this goes out to my black disabled people, father and son at the altar table. Father wanted to stay with his son. Fire, 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 bright red, the sun. Through the clouds, raining tears. Speaking the family's name, Anthony and Justin Mitchell. This goes out to my black disabled people. Father and son at the altar table. Beyond this earth, they are one. The story is the same. On the roof, during Hurricane Katrina, still waiting, finally made the media. Fire, fire, fire. Flames getting hotter. Disabled father and son staying together. Ambulance never came. The father's love for his son, waiting for the ambulance to come. Both are going back home. Daughter can't call on her cell phone. Father and son crip love in life and death. Flying high like a dove. Doves are crying on earth. Wings are burnt. L.A., this really hurts. Anthony and Justin Mitchell, it's your turn to get your wings for your second birth. Rest in peace, Anthony and Justin Mitchell.
So here we come back up to Uchun, and we are blessed to speak to our family from Wood Street Commons. Welcome, Jazz, to Poor People's Radio.
Thanks, Tiny. Happy to be here. I also have with me Aluma.
Welcome, relatives, to Poor People's Radio. Would you like to just set the tone of what happened at this current location you're at, Jazz?
There was an emergency sweep because of a shooting that happened, and Afuma can speak more to what went down.
They used that as an excuse to emergency evacuate. We had nothing to do with it. Nobody in the campsite had anything to do with it. Nothing. Apparently, this stuff happened somewhere else, and it kind of like what they call escalated to our area. That's basically what happened. And I just found out that they was going to make us move. So they just basically destroyed all my stuff, the whole tent, all my property, everything. It was through duress because had I not complied, they would arrest me.
You're in East Oakland. What part?
I'm in East Oakland on East 12th and 23rd.
It just concerns me. Once they start sniffing around and coming up with some BS excuse like that, then it's open season.
When they use the safe work zone ordinance or whatever, that's what they were basically supposed to do. They were supposed to tell everybody to leave so they can clean. And then we were supposed to come back. They ain't telling us, no, we got to go for good. And they tore all our tents and stuff down. Everything, all the structures that we had built is all gone.
Jazz, the estuary was where they were towing RVs.
So the estuary already happened. It was last week. They came while myself and one of the residents were scouting spots for people to move to because no one knew where they were going because they'd been there for a while. So we were looking for spots, and then we came back and the cops had the whole thing blocked off. They wouldn't let us bring the truck that we were going to use to move the vehicle with in, but they let us in to get people's stuff. But they were saying unless the vehicles are registered to people, they're going to tow them. They're totally ignoring the fact that these are people's homes, people live in them, and they're not offering them any alternatives. All the RV lots are full, and the shelter they're offering is mostly congregate, and then they maybe offered a couple people and got a couple people into cabins, but that was after their RVs were towed. So it's, yeah, you just took someone's permanent home, and after you do that, of course they're going to be, yeah, I want a roof over my head, even if it's a carceral one.
this already disgusting process of sweeping humans like we're trash and taking all our stuff has amped up now on another level. They're doing this on Saturdays and Sundays and whenever they can.
Yeah, it started, they were just doing weekdays during working hours, but now they had a sweep, this emergency sweep. The hours on the posting said from 12 p.m. to 8 p.m. that the city could arrive. The cops are getting paid overtime anyways. Like, if it's a sweep, the cops are getting paid overtime. If it's the weekend, they're getting paid overtime. But now the worker, like the city workers and the administrative workers that are doing this sweep, they're all getting paid overtime. So it's definitely another money-making scheme where they're like doing these weekend operations and they're doing late-night operations. Like when they did Wood Street, they had cops posted 24 hours overnight, and they're ramping up to do the rest of East 12th between 14th and 16th with citing the ERF funding, but who knows if they actually got the building available. And I wouldn't be surprised if they've been doing things kind of spotty, schedulized, that they might just be saving up overtime to try and clear people from here, which is terrifying.
Just like when we talk to our relatives from Devangar, poor people, houseless people, we have our own solutions. And they're not sweeping us from one place to the other at $80,000 to $90,000 to $100,000 an hour of police overtime salaries, which does nothing for anybody ever, anywhere. Wood Street Community, Wood Street Commons, our sister movement has a project that they are trying to get the gangsters to actually honor, to lift up, and to give space for. They've been talked a whole lot of mess from the city. There's never been an actual giving of this land. And we want to lift up that's a solution that is way cheaper, I might add, than millions of dollars of police and sheriff and DPW overtime. So let's talk about solutions. Let's talk about homefulness and how it's a solution, not let's talk about more sweeping humans. Because no, that's not a solution. What that is destruction and carceral system building and theft of poor people's lives and bodies. That's not a solution, Oakland, Frisco, L.A., the rest of occupied Turtle Island, and it's never been a solution. This is just about death, and being swept to death is what they want to try to do to us. Thank you so much, Jazz and Afuma and all the warriors out there, and you know, we'll be there.
Everyone addicted to the same nicotine. Everyone addicted to the same gasoline. Everyone addicted to a Technicolor screen. Everybody trying to get their hands on the same green.
We are blessed to have one of our Poor People's Radio graduates, the amazing Mama Sister Shiro, who was houseless on Wood Street with our Wood Street relatives, Wood Street Commons, for over 10 years, but also surviving the violent chemical warfare that continues to perpetrate on our bodies and lives as poor people and houseless folks and everybody, with or without a roof, with her new segment called Addiction Doula. Listen up.
This is the Poor News Network. Greetings and abundant risings. This is your addiction doula, Leger, on the Holistic Detox and Recovery segment, connecting you to traditional ways to be reborn and liberated from addiction and trauma. Today, we're going to be talking about my own personal recovery journey. I was battling with being heavily addicted to drugs while being unhoused on the streets of Oakland. In June 2023, I began my journey of recovering from 10 years of amphetamine and opiate addiction. My life and future began to be up for examination spiritually, physically, and emotionally. At the time in my treatment facility, I needed to have tools that were more geared to who I was, like being of African descent, needing to be connected to ways of healing without using more pharmaceuticals when I was just coming off of a chemical dependency. So when I completed 90 days, I started working with Essential Food and Medicine in developing a holistic detox and recovery support for others that are looking for alternatives or enhancements to 12-step programs. I'm in the process of stepping into the role as an addiction doula and mentor to offer people tools to support a better and healthy life for themselves. What has been life-changing for me is learning and using traditional ways of healing through spiritual guidance and medicine. With my own journey, I'm using the opportunity to learn different ways to work with healing practices from various indigenous cultures. The purpose is to bring my honest reflection and learning moments and share a holistic approach to recovery. During this segment, I will share my personal experience and different ways of thinking that I've found helpful in building strength in my journey healing from drug addiction. Thank you for listening to your Addiction Doula Leger on the Holistic Detox and Recovery segment, connecting you to traditional ways to be born and liberated from addiction.
I need the dollar, 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 that's what I need. Hey, hey. Well, I need the dollar, 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 that's what I need. Hey, hey. Said I need the dollar, 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 that's what I need. And if I share with you my story, would you share your dollar with me?
So that's all for these broadcasts. You can follow us on Facebook, X, or Instagram at Poor Magazine at Poverty Scholar. You can also get this complete Poor People's Radio podcast with all the interviews and conversations of any of our previous archive shows on iTunes, Spotify, iHeart, or whatever you get your podcast from. All power to the people.
Well, I don't know if I'm walking on solid ground, cause everything around me is falling down.
Black folk. Black look like a revolution. Look like a family reunion in the park. Black look like it's a different world. Sound like a crawfish ball in New Orleans. Black folk joke around like Martin and got paintings from JJ in the living room. It sounds strong. Look like sacrifice. It'd be flowers blooming in the summertime. Black sound like old songs. Smell like good food. And it tastes like heart disease, but it feel like maize at Jazz Fest. Black sound like something that hurt, like a hard test. Black sound like skin, like something dark. It look like hair, yeah, black sound like rough hair and good hair. Look like history, sound spiritual. Black sound like years, like working, like night. Black sound like money, look like Walmart. Like corner stores, like cash register singing. Black sound like 400 years. Smell like Oprah. Impactful like Martin. Look like Cicely Tyson. Sing like Nina. Got a like Serena. Feel like broken homes in Section 8. Black smell like crack and collard greens. Sounds motivational. Feels like church. Look like big Sunday hats and ribbons.
Smile like your mama, eyes like the sun, beautiful child, oh you're the one. Fly like your daddy, make me so happy, beautiful child, oh you're the one.
Sound like thick black swinging and sneaky uncles. Look like Tyler Perry making money. Sound like hating, feel frustrated, don't it? Like they don't get it. Like they won't ever get it, huh? Like push your personal feelings of racial injustice so far underneath the carpet that you trip over your own family history. But I love me some black folk. I love the hair grease and the rental fees. The front row seats, the police, the projects, the mustard greens, being late, social security checks, government assistance, bougie, black, looking good, bags of hair, fake press on nails, rat tail comb, stunting gold chain, gold teeth, black men and big feet. I love me some black folk. For they are the people that were made from the darkest parts of the sky.
Smile like your mama, eyes like the sun, beautiful child. Beautiful child, oh, you're the one. I'm in a place when I see your face. Must be nostalgia. I'll never forget the day that we met. Beautiful child.
Different things, pushing boundaries, west coast, east coast, overseas.
From the 504, what you think I came to LA for?
Everybody from the 504, what you think I came to LA for? Everybody from the 504, what you think I came to LA for? Everybody from the 504, what you think I came to LA for?
With the group Chicago, and you're listening to KBOO FM.
This is Bird Note. Christian Cooper is host of the National Geographic show Extraordinary Birder and author of the memoir Better Living Through Birding. But as a kid, Christian says he wasn't interested in birds until his parents made him take a woodshop class.
I had to build something, so I built a bird feeder and I put it up in the backyard.
Christian filled the feeder with cracked corn. And then
this bird shows up, all black except for this patch of red at the wings.
At first, Christian thought he discovered a new species of crow.
And I was thrilled with my preteen scientific prowess. And then I found out it was a red-winged blackbird. Oops. But still, to this day, one of my favorite birds, and they are the first sign of spring for me, because growing up on Long Island, they would all depart en masse, and I would get mildly depressed in the course of the winter, and then I would hear sometime in, like, March, okay. And I'd be like, they're back. They're back. Thank God they're back. Spring is here.
Before we know it, spring will be with us again. For Bird Note, I'm Joni Franklin.
Thank you.
listening to KBOO Portland at 90.7 FM.
That's Doc Watson, one of the many artists you can hear on the Cascadia Coffee House each Friday morning when we share a wide variety